All right. So no musings have been a little on and off lately, but thought we'd try to do a couple of them. Also kind of one programming note. Appreciate everyone's patience. I know that it's probably been a little choppy as we've been recording these podcasts remotely. Good news is I think we're getting better at it. I think that I'm getting a little more used to not having the guest sitting in front of me. Bad news is I'm in upstate New York and the connection often cuts out. And so we're stopping and starting and losing the flow. And so not as, you know, from that standpoint, not as good as we want. Although what I have found is that people are more available than ever to record a podcast because they're hanging out at home. And so I hope you feel like the quality of guests we've been getting is good. And, you know, we've been trying to put out at least two a week. And so hopefully that's working well for everyone. So first thing I wanted to cover, and this was my column for Fast Company on April 22nd. I'm not sure which podcast this will be attached to, but an idea. And I think I'm just going to read the column, which means if you've already read the column, you can just sort of skip ahead. But I like the idea and I kind of want to get it out there a little more because I really do think it would matter. So the headline of the column was "Assemble the Shadow Cabinet, How Joe Biden Can Beat Trump at His Own Reality TV Game." And here's the column itself. Maybe none of this matters. Maybe the presidential election will be solely determined by how Donald Trump handles the coronavirus, and the end result will be the same, whether Joe Biden runs an effective, vigorous campaign, or whether he goes on vacation for the next 6 months. But if you're a Democrat, hiding out in your basement doesn't feel like a winning strategy. Biden's home videos and avuncular podcast, Here's the Deal, aren't really catching fire. Meanwhile, Trump is dominating the airwaves as usual, using his daily coronavirus briefings to broadcast his political rallies and messages straight from the White House lawn. Team Biden needs to do something, need to amp up the X factor if they want to recapture the public's attention. And one way to do that is by playing the media's favorite parlor game, who's getting what job? Rather than waiting for the transition to select and announce his cabinet, Biden should do it now, and he should make it fun. Here's how it would work. Every week, Biden would name a new member of his presidential team. The campaign would announce which job will be filled next, give the media a few days to speculate about the potential candidates, and then Biden could hold a remote event revealing that week's choice. He could even interview each potential nominee on his podcast. He can call it the Apprentice White House Edition. Normally, in the usual jumble of transition announcements that are held traditionally in November and December, no one really cares who's being nominated as the next Secretary of Agriculture or Commerce or Labor. But in a pandemic, when everyone's at home and has nothing else to do, and they're starved for anything positive, anything new, this is going to get a lot of attention. In fact, a lot more attention than anything Biden's doing right now. And there's a substantive benefit, too. By pre-selecting his cabinet, Biden gives voters a much better sense of what they'd actually be voting for, and he can draw a real contrast with Team Trump. The White House is, you know, more than just the person sitting in the Oval Office. It's a collective enterprise whose success or failure is determined by the team, by political appointees, by civil servants, by smart management. And every time that Biden names a hyper-competent, highly respected leader to his future cabinet, it underscores his competence and really contrasts it against the current West Wing. It would show how much better he'd handle a global pandemic. It would show that he's a decisive leader who can put together a top team, lead with conviction, and solve a crisis. So imagine if Biden were to name Bill Gates as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. You know, putting the right-wing conspiracy theories aside, the idea of Gates helping manage the nation's response to COVID-19 would appeal to millions of voters, including many who are just tuning Biden right out altogether. Or imagine naming Andrew Cuomo or Gretchen Whitmer to high-level cabinet posts, or Preet Bharara or Stacey Abrams or Sally Yates as Attorney General. Imagine creating a role for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or AOC to develop policies to ensure that income inequality doesn't widen during the current pandemic. Imagine asking Andrew Yang to lead the efforts on introducing universal basic income. Imagine naming Bill Simmons to be the sports czar. The point is you can develop an entirely new mode of campaigning, one in which you can activate specific portions of the electorate for each person you appoint, which I think is a pretty savvy twist on micro-targeting in the age of reality TV. Now, look, traditionalists are going to argue that it's too risky for Biden to do this. They'd say that you can't announce your cabinet before the election, and I understand where they're coming from. Political appointees do need time to be vetted properly. But Biden could begin rolling out his selections now and start with public figures who've already been vetted, who've already been subject to rigorous scrutiny, you know, highly elected public officials, people who are for president, things like that. And then anyone who requires more vetting can be announced later in the process in July or August. And sure, will someone that Biden name say something stupid between now and Election Day? Absolutely. Are the odds of any of them being more gaffe prone than Biden himself? You know, almost zero. And look, Biden needs a gimmick. He needs something different. He's a career politician running against the greatest entertainer ever to occupy the Oval Office. Trump sucks up all the oxygen in the room or on a Zoom on a normal day. During a global pandemic, competing with him for attention is like screaming into a hurricane. The usual playbook isn't going to cut it. Team Biden has to try something different, something that gets the media excited, something that gives voters a way to see the type of leader he'll be. Personnel is policy, as they say. And when Biden is as known for saying you're hired as Trump is you're fired, he'll be halfway to victory in November. Okay, welcome back to another episode of Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. Really fun guest with me today, a guy that I've just been getting to know over the last couple of months. Zach Grauman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So Zach is remote in Jacksonville right now. I am upstate. Maura is producing this from Long Island. But we will still hopefully make this all come together pretty well. And Zach and I, we probably only met maybe like 2 months ago. Is that right? Kind of late February?
Yeah. Right after Zach, the campaign, right?
Right. Yeah, you were right. So Zach, we'll talk a lot about this, you know, just finished managing Andrew Yang's presidential campaign. Right as kind of Yang was coming out is when Bloomberg was coming on. And I was one of the many people who tried to solicit their support. And while that didn't happen, Zach and I somehow have become friends. So I guess it worked out.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've had this pretty fascinating career. And obviously, everyone listening to this is very familiar with Yang and probably has heard of you as well. But like, you didn't have the traditional path of a presidential campaign manager. So you just give the listeners some sense of your past and how you got to this point.
Yeah, I think definitely least experienced and possibly least qualified person to be running a presidential campaign. Well,
the results sense. Wouldn't necessarily agree with that.
It's been a journey. So I a kind of interesting background. My mom was a teacher and my dad was a engineer, kind of entrepreneur type. So I grew up very, very fascinated about the way public and private sectors work together. Like for-profits and nonprofits. And then when I graduated college, I went to Duke University. So go Blue Devils. I realized I may have pissed off half your audience.
More, two thirds. Yeah.
And it's deserved, man, geez. When I was a senior, I had two job offers, and one was to do to go work on Wall Street, doing at UBS, doing wealth management in that program. And then the other one was to work and teach for America in post-Katrina New Orleans with special needs kids. And so one was like, go make money and go into business like my dad. And the other one was go save the world and help people like my mom. And I remember hating that decision, you know, and it's probably something you've had. Actually, I know you've had,
yeah.
You talk about a little bit. Yeah. Where most people have is like, I can go make money and do well, or I can do good and not make any money.
Right. And did your parents each kind of come out on the side you would have predicted or no?
They were good. The big one was I had student loans like most millennials. And so is as hard as like a moral decision was, as an easy financial, like logical decision is like yeah, make some money before you can help anybody. So I took the Wall Street job, but I started volunteering a lot. So I'm working at UBS in New York City. But to get like my save the world kick, I eventually joined the board of a school down in Brooklyn in a low income area there. And, we did a survey as a middle school kid and we asked everybody what you want to be when you grow up. And all the kids said they want to be LeBron James or Beyonce. It was like either athlete or superstar. And anyway, I was like, man, I don't even know what I want to be when I grow up. These kids don't know what they can be. You know, they know their options. And it seemed like such a solvable problem to me. So the long story short, as I was working at UBS, I ended up starting this nonprofit called Suit Up. So we run, I run volunteer events for big companies or companies in general. So instead of your park cleanups or your soup kitchens, we do business competitions and we do them for low-income kids like the school I was working at. Where the kids like design a new shoe for Nike or create a new pair a new product for Beats or a brand they recognize. So the company gets this better volunteer day, the school gets increased career awareness, and the kids learn why they're there. And it was awesome. This thing was great. Companies pay for it. So it was growing like a weed. I was going to leave and go start this, like run this thing full time. And then I ended up, my boss at the time at UBS said, hey, why don't you check out our client philanthropy team before you quit your day job? So I ended up eventually helping run the UBS client philanthropy advisory group. So we work with wealthy families to give money to charity. And then I was running this nonprofit. And that's how I ended up meeting Andrew. So that was like my background pre-politics.
And how did you and he end up first start intersecting?
So Andrew, completely unknown before in nationally, internationally, anywhere, but in the small subset of social entrepreneurship and philanthropic expertise, he was very well known. He had started something called Venture for America, which is like Teach America, but for startups. So they take smart kids out of, you know, the Ivies and you name it. And they train them in 2-year boot camp, and then they bring them to startups to learn to run companies in Detroit and Cleveland and Baltimore. And then they get a seed capital when they're done to start their own company in those target cities. And so in the nonprofit space, it's unheard of to be a startup nonprofit, to go from like zero or $100,000 in budget to $6 million in budget. That's unheard of in a short period of time, unless you're funded by like a billionaire or these big backers. And Andrew was not. So that's why he was this very much revered in the social entrepreneurship space. He had written a book. So my clients liked talking to him. We'd invite him to events. I would bring him to like we had like rich kid events, if you will. So the millennial kids of our wealthiest clients would come in, and how the heck do you inherit $100 million? Sounds pretentious, but it actually is a bit of a problem for some. So Andrew would come in and get to know these people. It's a good problem.
Yeah, like, deep existential problem.
Well, I actually felt bad for some of these kids. Like, parents like, well, here's $1 billion. And they're like, that sounds awesome at first. And they're like, what the heck do I do with more money I've ever seen? I've never earned it before. There's like a massive existential crisis kids have. You have to do that well to carry on a family name and make sure they don't blow it. So that's how I got to know Andrew. So I go to this, the story was I go to this dinner, it was supposed to be on, it was like a kind of a pretentious dinner about the future of work. But it was supposed to be like an interesting kind of Jeffersonian roundtable discussion on future work. And Andrew shows up uninvited, unannounced, if you will. I'm sure someone invited him, but he just shows up.
Yeah, he didn't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I'm crashing restaurants every night looking for a...
Correct. Someone invited him, but he wasn't like on the agenda. He was on the guest list, whatever. And he's such a force. And so he comes in and then starts talking. And I'm like rolling my eyes because I'm like, I was hoping to learn something tonight. And I'm just going to get the Venture for America spiel, which is great, but not what I came here for. But he doesn't do that. He goes and drops this automation bomb talking about the fourth industrial revolution, that we're going to automate away all these jobs, and basically scares the heck out of everybody in the room. And then, so this was fall of 2017, like late summer, early fall 2017. Trump had just won. It was like a year and a half into almost a year into his election, right? And he drops this bomb and he's like, we need to go to universal basic income as soon as possible, $1,000 a month. And I'm running for president. And the room is just silent. It's like... Of America, like of that country,
yeah, of this restaurant,
the restaurant of my city block. Like, no one knew, like, yeah, I'm running for the country. And so, I don't know what was crazier, him. And I've said, you know, anybody asked me how you joined, like, that was the story. And I was like, the stupid idealist in me was like, Andrew, I'm in, I'm happy to help. So, pretty soon, I quit my UBS job. New York Times came out with a piece that said Andrew Yang is a longer than long shot for the White House in 2020. And we set out in our like tiny, crazy presidential campaign. That was February 2018.
So, I mean, you know, you guys obviously came a lot closer than you really had any right to. Did you have any idea it was going to go like that? And what are the 3 or 4 things that you think that the decisions that you made and Andrew made that really kind of propelled this thing?
Yeah. So I get that question a lot where it's like, how lucky were you? Or there's no way you could have thought you'd done this well. And it's kind of twofold. Like, on one hand, like, we were wildly successful, more than we ever could have, like, humanly imagined, right? At the same time, and like, there were some things that, like, rolled our way, right? But at the same time, and you, like, Andrew and I, if we ever, like, really honest with each other, like, when people are like, did you think you'd get this far? We're stupid enough to say, yeah, we did. Like, we actually thought, like, I sized up the field. And a couple thoughts. I was like, one, like, how the heck do you beat Donald Trump? I thought you either line up the party behind one, like, plain, like, standard Democrat, which was what we ended up doing with Joe Biden, and Bloomberg was a shot there too. Yeah, we ended up doing that. But the other one was, I thought, would be an outsider, completely unknown, who would be kind of the nerd, like, the facts and figures to the Donald Trump. And we were close with that with, Andrew was one option, or Pete, and even Amy in some sense too. But Pete was a real outsider out of nowhere, Pete Buttigieg, and then Andrew. So I remember stacking up the candidates, and I thought, I think we are fifth or sixth, maybe fourth, if you wanted, depending on how this shakes out. And that's where we landed. And I thought we could win too. But so, like, the crazy was me. Like, I actually thought we could. But that said, we had no experience, no money, no list, no political connections, no publicly held office, no name recognition, literally nothing. But we had what I thought a lot of candidates lacked, was a why. We had a really good reason to run. We had a really powerful message that needed to be heard. That one, we're going to this fourth industrial revolution, we're automating away all the jobs, and two, we need to rewrite the rules of the economy to prepare us for this and, like, lead into the 21st century. And so, besides the why, right, which I think is really important, there are a couple of things we did. I basically had kind of three principles I had the whole time that worked really well. So number one was, you can't just be good, you got to be different. We knew it was going to be a crowded field. We knew it was going to be like a lot like the Republican field. So we knew that standing out would be more valuable than fitting in, right? And that the traditional talking points of the Democrat Party weren't going to work. So anywhere from, yes, $1,000 a month and, like, messaging, but also little things like not wearing a tie on the debate stage, right? He didn't say a word that first debate, but he was trending on Twitter, like, I think the day before and the day after, or the day of and the day after. But it was, you know, we knew traditional media wasn't working. So we did podcasts like this, where we knew there were people who listened to this complicated message. So that was one, like, we, particularly in the beginning, we did everything we could to be different. The second one was most important, was like, how do you brand him? So alternative media, whether it's podcasts or memes, we did a lot of. But the big one I love was identity branding, which I call is when you allow kind of that visceral human connection to the brand. So the example is the Yang Gang. So when we first started the Yang Gang, we were like, we need a name for the volunteers so that, people could feel part of this campaign. And so it was like, think of Donald Trump, right? Like, if you look in 2016, where you're like, who are you voting for? You're like, oh, people are like, oh, I'm voting for John Kasich. I'm looking at Cruz and looking at Rubio. And people be like, no, I'm MAGA. You know what I'm saying? It was visceral. Yep. It was this, I am part of that. So we knew we had to find a name. Andrew's Army, not very catchy. You know, a whole bunch of things. So we found someone had used the hashtag Yang Gang really early on. And I was like, that's it. And my team was like, this is a disaster. No way. It sounds inappropriate. No one wants to be in a gang. And I was like, we'll find something better. We couldn't. We went with it. And now the Yang Gang, I mean, what? We raised $40 million, one of the most powerful political forces in the country. And it's because they felt part of the campaign. We did a lot to bring Andrew's identity into the Yang Gang and his supporters. And then I'd say the last thing we did was not only that branding, was like building and organizing that army. So one of the best things we did was online. I've talked about this before. We got hammered. When you're born from the internet, like, you end up opening up some of the dark corners of the internet, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it's one of the things Bernie's campaign struggled with. Trump's campaign still struggles with, aside the embraces. And we didn't want, like, we want the internet and the passion and the virality that comes with it, but we didn't want the nastiness, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But it's tough to be like, that's okay and that's not okay. It's tough to, you can't regulate the internet that way. So what we did was, instead of saying, this is what we're against, this is what we're against, this is what we're against, we said, this is what we're for. And we put out our, we called it Humanity First values. So we stand for abundance, we stand for logic, we stand, you know, a number of things. And so that empowered, like, online moderators who look at Reddit and look at, you know, freaking Facebook groups or whatever they, whatever platform you're using, to say, that's what we stand for, that's what we don't stand for. And it was this guiding beacon throughout, which kept the Yang Gang, in my opinion, pretty wholesome. So that stuff worked a lot. Those are the big three, I'd say. And then, you know, like, decisions throughout, you know, the tactical decisions happen within those principles, you know.
What was it like watching both the candidates who ended up kind of staying in there about as long as you guys did, and then all of these sort of very successful politicians who didn't last nearly as long as Andrew did? How did they think of you guys? How did their attitudes change? Did some of them sort of get it? Were they all just assholes? Like, what was that like?
It was weird at first, you know, and I don't blame them. Cause I, you know, Andrew and I, while we ran an anti-establishment campaign, like, we both grew up in the establishment in some capacity, right? I worked on Wall Street. It was the most buttoned up place there is. Andrew was a corporate lawyer. But he's raised money from the establishment and has worked with them and partner, things like that. So, you know, they're looking at us like we got six heads, you know. I'll never forget. I don't know if I've really told this story. So there's an event in South Carolina called the Jim Clyburn's Fish Fry. And it's one of the biggest Democratic events there is. And so we go there and every candidate's there, like Wayne Messam to Biden and everything in between. And it's like 100 degrees outside at night. And there's like 2,000 people packed into this, like, it's almost like a bullpen the way it's set up. It's like this, it's like pen. And there's a restaurant on top. So they're all on the bottom. And then there's a stage. And the candidates are in this tinier bullpen on the side. And everybody could only bring one plus one. So it's every candidate and like their spouse, usually, because there wasn't enough room. And we're all wearing these Jim Clyburn blue t-shirts. And then it was me and Andrew were in there. And this was early. Like, we didn't know anybody. Like, we weren't polling anywhere, you know, anywhere. Hadn't been around for long. And everybody knows each other and it's super chummy. You know, everybody gets a gracious 1 minute to give their pitch and they come off. And literally they're all friends because, you know, they're in the Senate or Congress together. So they go up and they're like high-fiving each other, you know?
Was there any one candidate that stood out to you as someone who either understood Andrew's potential or was just exceptionally hostile towards the whole concept of you guys?
So that's actually perfect. This is how the story ends. So we're at the Climb Fish Fry, and as people are coming off the stage, they're super chummy. They're like high-fiving each other. It's like an adult softball game, you know? It's like, great job, Beto, or whatever it is. And Andrew comes off, and so they're chanting Andrew's name in the crowd. They're going, for some reason, we had a huge, huge support in there. And no one knew who this guy was. And he's up there like a pro wrestler, like screaming. They're all just like, he jumps into the crowd. And everybody, so he comes off stage and there's no high fives for Andrew. It's not like, well done, Andrew. It's like crickets, except for Joe Biden. Joe Biden was like, this is amazing. So it was one of my favorite stories. Cause like, now a lot, he's one of the most loved politicians in the game right now, if you can call him politician, I guess. But Joe has always been, really, really responsive to Andrew, as a human. But also, Joe is well liked by everybody and obviously well respected. But Joe, the vice president really understands, the former vice president really understands the need, and the impact of the fourth industrial revolution. He actually spent a lot of time studying it before he ran. it is baked in, it was kind of baked into his talking points in the beginning. You know, I think it was a lot of them just took warming up, but the ones that he, Andrew and myself too, became closest to on the trail were the ones that were closer to him in age. So Kamala and Corey, and Tulsi even a bit, because there's a cut from a similar cloth in that sense. And there's someone like Bernie and Joe, like we love them, but they're old enough to be Andrew's dad, you know? So that's it's a different rapport, you know?
So it's a good segue into the campaign itself. So now it's April 14th. Biden is, you know, the nominee, but can't leave his basement. Yeah. How do you see this thing unfolding? What will it come down to? And if the Biden campaign asked you, or they may be asking you, like, what should we do? What would you recommend?
Man, what a wild. We got out, I feel like, at the right time, because it just got really sideways shortly after. I think what's crazy is that when I was, you know, we were first looking to run, or like, who's going to win? Who's the front runners? It was like, all right, this is Biden, Bernie, and then maybe Warren or Bloomberg will make some noise. And then that was like, what, January 2019? And then January 2020, I could say the exact same thing, right? Like, you got Biden, Bernie, front runner, and then maybe Bloomberg and Warren. How I see this race, I mean, look, I didn't think the Democrats could do it, but I'm really happy we did, is that they lined up behind a candidate. Because I think that's the united front you need to beat Donald Trump. One of my takeaways from this election is that, and this is kind of dark, Bradley, but I think it's true, is that nobody cares. It's not that we don't care about the country, but the reality is like, in terms of your actions, you don't. Like, we have so many things that are distracting us and pulling us back. A lot of the stuff we would freak out about, or the political press would freak out about, like, barely made a dent, if at all, into the average voter's or average American's life. It's one of the reasons you guys and the Bloomberg gang did really well without having contending in some of the early states, because, like, while those states used to direct the press, they don't really seem to as much anymore, and their importance has changed in the 21st century. So I do think it is tough for Biden to be like stuck in his basement or stuck in quarantine while in a time when we all would like him to be leading, you know, not that he's not leading, but you know, like him have the ability to lead. But the whole thing flipped on its head, man. I have no idea. I would love your thoughts. I think he has a better shot of winning than people are saying in some instances. I think he's a very different candidate than Hillary Clinton in terms of a bunch of different things. But I think a lot of people put them in a similar bucket because they are typically, quote unquote, establishment candidates in the primary. But I think he's got a shot in the Midwest. I think he's got a shot in Arizona. I think he's got a shot in North Carolina and possibly in Florida. Those are states that, you know, you guys know better than any of the teams I worked with, like, knew those are the most important states in the primaries and in the general. So, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the question I struggle with is, if Biden runs a super aggressive campaign, or if he literally went on vacation till November 4th, would it have any impact on the outcome at all? And I'm not sure it would. You know, re-elections are always a referendum on the incumbent. Trump is a force unto himself, for better and for worse, like no one ever else has been. And now we're in the middle of a once-a-century pandemic and recession or depression, which all means that I think you'll have 100%, literally, of the American public, probably close to 100% awareness of who the candidates are, and almost 100% of them will have an actual somewhat formed view on whether Donald Trump should be president or not. And that's what they're going to express, right? And clearly, there's turnout, and that's important, and you want to rally as much as possible. And clearly, you somehow want to be able to get the Bernie bros without alienating everyone in the center. And clearly, you're going to have, if the pandemic comes back in the fall, concerned about people voting in person. And so you're going to have more states doing vote by mail, or hopefully, in my world, vote on your phone. So there's a lot of different things that obviously you need to do. But with that said, arguably Biden, everybody knows who he is. Nobody doubts that he's sort of qualified for the job. No one sees him anything other than a career politician. And so, you know, him is the alternative to Trump. It's a very steady thing. Trump is a very unsteady thing by nature. And just, you know, obviously the Biden people will run the most aggressive campaign they can, but I'm not sure it will end up making any difference in either direction with the ultimate outcome is my guess.
Who knows? I know. I think I agree with you. People know, like think of how many stories have come out hammering Biden and Trump, and they just stayed the course, you know?
Yeah.
People know that.
Trump's numbers haven't moved in 4 years. And yeah, they're always within a pretty narrow band. Like worst ever gets is like approval rating, like around 40. Best is around 45, 46. And that's it. And it's always right around there. So UBI, like how do you see the issue progressing both over the course of the campaign? And then second, how do you think kind of coronavirus makes that, it brings that issue either into more stark relief or obscures it?
Right. So I'll first start by saying that I'm a Buffalo Bills fan and I hate moral victories because we had a lot of those.
Four
moral victories. And then, you know, a decade, 2 decades of just, you know, we're almost out of this year, guys. At least our young defensive end looked good. Like, no, we lost. So like as proud as I am in the campaign and I feel really good about what we did, we still lost. Like that we were running to win. But I am proud of the legacy we're leaving, both from like how to run a campaign, but also the issues. And I think by the numbers, like there's a whole bunch of different surveys, but more than half of Democrats are in favor of universal basic income. Half the country's open to it. You're looking at some really positive movement of the needle in that field, and that's exciting. And then what is really exciting to me is the Andrew Yang legacy is not going anywhere, which was what the hope was, because he might be the only person to run for president and lose early that becomes immediately cooler right after. There's probably a few other examples, but there's not a lot. Because it, like, so I'm on, I go, we launched this nonprofit shortly after, which is exciting, Humanity Forward. Just to kind of maintain the momentum. And then I'm like, I'm going to Mexico because it's been 2 years of campaigning. I'm exhausted. And I'm there for 4 days. And the next thing I know, Corona's happening. And what idea are we looking to do to save the country? Universal basic income. We're looking at cash payments to Americans. So that I blew up my vacation in a good way in some ways. But I think like Andrew was running and we were running because not because it was like, hey, listen to Andrew, he's amazing. He's like, no, he's right. And the threats and the changes and the shifts in the world that we were talking about because of automation are now accelerated faster than I ever thought they would be accelerated. And the need for universal basic income is even greater. And people know it. People feel it because right now they physically can't work. But these companies, man, and you know this, you're a business guy, like, these companies that have laid off their workforce, they're not hiring back at the same rate. In many instances, it won't even be close. It won't even be close. So, you need a solution that works is where I was going. Yeah. Keep going.
No, so is there a way to take what's, because you're right, there's a $1,200 cash payment. And even the PPP in some ways is like an indirect form of UBI, right? Because it's at least cash going directly to businesses and therefore hopefully employees, as opposed to going through government programs and bureaucracies, right? Because look, one of the reasons that I've always been intrigued by UBI is having run a government in Illinois, I'm pretty aware of what government can and can't do well. And the same $100, if washed through the system and the government, you know, does $50 worth of good. And if that $100 is in someone's pocket 90% of the time, it will do $100 worth of good. And I believe in government, but still, I just think you have to be realistic about it. But in some ways, conceptually, the notion of just direct cash transfers is really what the CARES Act is, right? And so how do you guys sort of use that to further the case overall?
So a couple thoughts. One is, what is exciting is I like to think, I think I have to think that what we're talking about would not have been presented or like readily on the table if we hadn't run. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Where it's like,
yeah,
in the crisis, you know what you know. It's like, well, why don't we just do that whole giveaway cash thing? You know, that because of Andrew and what we did, that became an option. And then people started looking at the actual feasibility of it and liked it. And if you're talking about like, you're going to need solutions that work, this one will. So I think like, how do we carry on? I think $1,200, great first step. Improving unemployment benefits, like great first step. And like going through small businesses instead of like a government bureaucracy, I think is a good step. I think it's the first step to me would have been, you could have gone around the businesses and gone directly to people, right? I think you would have, and Andrew, I was talking about this, like, I think you would have, the businesses wouldn't need the money so much if they could have just cut payroll and the government could have, you know, helped or could have limited payroll and things like that. That's usually their biggest expense. Or if they knew, hey, we're going to shut down, you're not going to starve, you know, we're all going to hunker down a bit. That's something that could have happened. I think what's going to happen from here on out is if we can't get the economy rolling and people start getting back to work soon, which seems to be the case, although there's some rumblings of things starting to open up, you're going to have a lot of people continuously hurting. And the need for solutions that work will continue to be there. So I honestly, what we're doing with Humanity Forward is literally just raising money and giving it out to people in need, because that is the single most effective thing you can do for people that are struggling right now. And what we're finding is it works. And a lot of the data on this is really promising, but I think just in a principle standpoint, like what you, like, if you just gave a lot of people money, we'd solve a lot of like the short-term problems we're having. And like even some of the dark ones, like I think like domestic abuse is rising and things like that, like giving some people cash, would give people the ability to drive away or like stay in a motel or things like that. Some of the dark stuff of Corona too. But I believe we just hit the tip of the iceberg on this. I don't think the conversation on universe-based income is going away, because it, to me, is the only thing that's working on a large enough scale.
And so how do you guys then kind of over the next few years keep the momentum going? Is that by Andrew working in a Biden administration? Is it by him running for mayor of New York? Is it by him becoming the media personality? How do you do it?
So I would like, one of the things I love about Andrew is that you can't really put him in a box. You know, it's, is he the free money guy? Like partially, sure. Is he kind of a nerdy genius? Yeah. Like, is he hilarious? Yeah. Is he now a media figure? In some instances, yes. Is he an entrepreneur? Yes. Is he a nonprofit guy? Yes. So there's a lot of things he does. It's kind of tough to fit him in. I think he's been, so right now, I mean, one of the things we've been trying to do is keep the ideas relevant and keep him relevant, so that he has options to keep not fitting into boxes. So he's been on CNN, which I think he's been doing. I think he's been a welcome perspective on there. And I think he stays true to himself. We're starting a podcast, Yang Speaks, which is coming this spring, sometime this April, 2020. We're working on Humanity Forward to make, basically realize and mainstream a lot of the ideas of the campaign, not just universal basic income, but some of the stuff we have about modernizing our government and engaging voters who never worked before and getting people paid for their data and rewriting the rules and measurements of the economy, a lot of stuff like universal basic income, just a tip of what Andrew's vision is. The reason I think we stay relevant, Bradley, is like, we have to go this way. You're seeing what happens when the system breaks. When a government is not able to respond to its people in a crisis, it's a disaster. And I think we're seeing that when the country's under the gun, whose ideas are they turning to? The ideas of Andrew Yang. We need new ideas. So I hope and I pray, and I know you do too, for this like newer generation of leadership to come to the forefront. And for the rest of us to have an open mind for bigger ideas, because the world's flipped on its head.
Yeah. And look, there's arguably no better potential stimulus package than truly embracing UBI, right? So if this doesn't bounce back in a few months, it'll mean two things. One, we'll probably have President Biden, which is good. And two, you know, we'll hopefully have you guys in an influential spot one place or another to lay out how they should do this.
I think, yeah, I think that'd be, Andrew's big on solving the problems, and no matter who was in that seat, he was really open to working with. I can't say I'm thrilled about moving to DC if that ever happened. I don't know. But
the only good news about that, I can tell you, having had that experience, is I don't love DC as a city, although it's much better now than when I was there. But you're only going into a job like that if you're planning on working 24/7 anyway. So it's the kind of thing where you're just like, fuck it. I'm just going to be in the office till 10 o'clock at night, and that's what it is. That's the point of you're having this job. Yeah. So, you know, that's the only silver lining, which is not great. But all right. Well, Zach, good luck with the podcast. Congrats on everything so far. And hopefully we can keep talking to you.
Congrats to you and everything you're building. It's good. It sucks that we had to catch up on a podcast, but it's good to hear your voice, man. I'm glad you're doing it. You know, staying safe.
Same here. Thanks, man.
Thank you, sir.